Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm your host, Dave Custy. And my guest today is Dr. Joseph J. Ciotola. Dr. Joseph J. Ciotola is a top-rated orthopedic surgeon at Orthopedics and Joint Replacement at Mercy Medical Center. Board certified, Dr. Ciotola's extensive expertise in anterior hip replacement makes him one of the most sought-after orthopedic surgeons in the Baltimore region for hip replacement. Dr. Ciotola also specializes in knee replacement as well as knee resurfacing using Makoplasty, powered by RIO robotic arm technology. Dr. Ciotola's dedication to providing advanced orthopedic techniques help bring anterior hip replacement to orthopedics and joint replacement at Mercy. Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio, Doctor.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself in your own words, a little short bio.
Well, I got interested in orthopedic surgery because of my father, who was an orthopedic surgeon, and he would always bring me on rounds and around the hospital when I was a young child, and I grew up around it and really enjoyed working with him. I went into practice with him in 2003 when I got out of residency, and that was a lot of fun. We worked together for 3 years in private practice and, shared a lot of insight, and I was able to really benefit from his experience. And then I learned about, I was always interested in, we're always interested in doing things that are the least invasive or the most gentle to the patient to cure the disease at hand. And that's what really turned me on to the anterior approach. That is a technique for replacing the hip that does not require cutting any of the muscles around the hip. So it can be done very gently, very accurately on a special operating room table with the use of fluoroscopy to position the components of the hip in a very accurate position. So a lot of the problems that we were facing with hip replacement, long recovery, pain, delay getting back to work, delay getting back to a normal gait, having a problem of leg length inequality, typically where the operated leg was longer and that occasionally damaged to nerves and blood vessels, was a problem. And the solution of the anterior approach has been wonderful. It takes the risk and the complications from the hip replacement surgery down to less than 1% across the board. It is a technique that was originated in 1946 in France on a special operating room table that allowed extension of the hip, I mean, lowering it down towards the floor to facilitate putting the components in between the muscles so that you could just separate the muscles without actually detaching them from the bone. And you could also preserve the capsular, most of the capsule of the hip, which is a great restraint to dislocation. So patients weren't experiencing the risk of, or the complication of dislocation after the anterior approach that we were seeing as traditional techniques. So it was brought to the United States in the late 90s by a surgeon out in L.A., which is who I learned it from and picked it up on. The problem became the operating room table was the biggest hurdle because the old French table went out of production and there was nothing else to really comparable that could facilitate it. So they had to redesign a table. And Dr. Mata, working out in L.A., worked with the OSI company to design the current HANA table, we call it, and that really is what facilitated the technique. And that is what facilitated me moving my practice to Mercy. When my dad retired in 2006, I had been struggling already for about 4 years to get one of the other hospitals to purchase this HANA table to allow me to do this technique, and I was finally able to get Mercy to have the confidence in it and the confidence in me, and they went ahead and did that. So I moved my practice down to Mercy and took on the anterior approach. I trained on it for about a year and a half in cadaver labs and with other surgeons all across the country to make sure that I was comfortable because obviously I had nobody to fall back on when tackling this in a real patient. So I wanted to make sure that I was well-trained and confident and comfortable with the technique and the anatomy before taking it on. And then I did the first surgery in 2006 in the fall. And it went extremely well, and the patients were doing remarkable. So it really took off from there with just word of mouth with my practice, and it's become wonderful. It's exploded. It's the fastest growing technique across the country, and I've been teaching it to other surgeons now since 2007. just to inform you of what the differences are, what the patient would be interested in. It's a relatively small incision between the front and the side of the hip, about 5 inches long. Like we said, doesn't cut any muscle. The surgery now usually takes me about a half an hour to an hour, depending on the size of the patient. And the patient, it's usually done under a spinal anesthetic. The patient's usually in the hospital just 1 or 2 days, getting pain medication, blood thinners, and some physical therapy to make sure that they're safe and able to go home. After the patient goes home, there's typically no need for any physical therapy, no hip precautions, which means rules about moving the hip around. There's no special equipment like there is with traditional surgery. There's no pillow between the legs. There's no bedside commode. There's no elevated toilet seat. There's no moving the bedroom to the first floor. Patients are typically driving between 5 and 14 days after the surgery and back to work by 2 weeks for a desk job and 4 to 6 weeks for a labor job. They're usually back in the gym by 6 weeks to start working out once all the inflammation is settled down. And after the surgery and they've recovered, there's no real restrictions on their physical activities. And I've had patients that go back to a very active lifestyle of doing some light running, competitive weightlifting, surfing, golf, tennis, yoga. All these things are possible after the anterior approach, and patients are enjoying a much more active and full quality of life as opposed to what they had to deal with before.
Sounds wonderful. Been doing it for 10 years. What was it like when you first started out? And then tell us what it was like when your father retired and all. What was the surgery like then? And then we'll talk about how mainstream this is getting.
Well, traditional hip replacements are either done through something called the posterior approach or the anterior lateral approach. The anterior lateral approach is what I was most comfortable with because that's what my father did. And that would require cutting the anterior third of the gluteal muscles or the abductor muscles off the hip to gain access to the joint to put the components in. It was good in a way that it allowed for accurate positioning of the components, and it had a relatively low dislocation rate. The problem with that technique was a significant percentage of patients, sometimes up to 5%, would have a significant and permanent limp because of weak abductor muscles that would not heal back sufficiently to the bone. And it would require, we would still put the patients on hip precautions with pillows between their legs, rules about bending over and crossing their legs, wouldn't allow them to do any active abduction strengthening until the muscles healed back. And that was the downside of that technique. The other technique that I explored was the posterior approach, which was more attractive because the patients wouldn't have that limp that they had from the anterior lateral approach, but it risked injury to the sciatic nerve and positioning of the components and was a little more difficult, and cutting out the posterior capsule on the external rotator muscles in the back of the hip would lead to a higher rate of dislocation in those patients. So that was the downsides of that technique. The downsides of the anterior approach are really none to the patient. There is no patient that needs a hip replacement that's not a candidate for the anterior approach if they're a candidate for hip replacement. So it's really something that's an option for all patients, which makes it, very, very attractive.
My limited experience with people who've had hip replacement are older people. And basically, after they got a hip replacement, it wasn't so bad. It took a longer period than 6 weeks to do heavy labor if they did that at all. But, I mean, this sounds like it's revelatory. Is this becoming more mainstream, or are you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It was, I was the first to really tackle it on this HANA table in the Baltimore, Washington, and Mid-Atlantic area, and it's exploded now to where most hospitals have a table and most of the surgeons are interested in it if they're not already doing it. So it's becoming much more mainstream. And what tends to happen is when a surgeon in a town that doesn't do it begins doing it, his practice grows exponentially. Just from word of mouth of the patients, because it's so dramatically different for the patient in terms of the recovery compared to everything else. And that really kind of lights up the other surgeons in the area that take a look at it. And that's what we've seen. I've trained surgeons, especially up in New Hampshire. I've trained surgeons in Pennsylvania, in New Jersey, and they've all shared with me their experience when they go back to town. And within a year, their practice volume has tripled, and other surgeons in the area are starting to ask, like, what are you doing, you know, because you know, we're losing our patients to you, and your patients are doing wonderful, and we'd like to know what's going on. And that's kind of what, that's the way it grows.
Are the results the same regardless of age?
They are. I mean, obviously, younger, more active patients can bounce back faster than the older, deconditioned patient. But with the advantage to the older, deconditioned patient is that you're providing minimal trauma to them, and you're giving them the best opportunity to recover with the muscle that they have left. Also, for the obese patients, there's typically less fat anteriorly, and the surgery is actually technically easier on a heavier patient than it would be to do a traditional technique on them. So that's the advantage to the older and the out-of-shape patient. The advantage to the younger, more athletic patient is that you're preserving all their wonderful muscle and anatomy so that they can go back to being very, very functional very quickly.
Sounds great. So what's Dad think of all this?
Oh, my dad loves it. I mean, he couldn't believe it. He can't believe how busy I've become because of it.
Oh, yeah.
And he thinks it's just absolutely wonderful, you know, that patients are benefiting from this.
Does he wish he had it in his day?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And he was fighting for me to get this and take it on, even being the chief of surgery at Kernan at the time. We couldn't convince the hospital to put down $100,000 to buy this table and take on this endeavor, but I was able to be realized in Mercy, and that's been a wonderful blessing for all of us.
Let me ask you about knee replacement right now. There's something called Makoplasty, powered by a robotic arm, and then I'll ask you, what do you think all these operations and such are going to go in the future? But first, about knee replacement. You specialize in that, too.
Sure. Yeah, hip, knee, and shoulder is my main focus of my practice, and I apply the same philosophy and the same mission statement to everything I do. So what we're trying to do with a knee replacement is resurface the knee joint, replace the worn out cartilage with metal and plastic parts through the least amount of trauma and the most balanced and technically accurate way to give the patient the best functional outcome. The greatest advance in knee replacement up to this point, and we're talking total knee replacement now, has been our management of the patient's postoperative pain so that they can facilitate their rehab, their range of motion, and their strengthening of the leg. So Mercy instituted a joint journey program, which is a coordinated effort between the nurses, the anesthesiologists, the orthopedic surgeons, the physical therapists, to get the patients adequately covered in pain, but still very functional and supported with a good home network and coaching system so that they can get their quality of life back as soon as possible. What that entails, in short, is medication cocktails, injections, regional blocks, and limited use of narcotic pain medication to facilitate a functional recovery. And that's been the most dramatic impact on the function after knee replacement of late. What the Mako is a robot used to facilitate partial knee replacement. Some patients who have only arthritis in one part of the knee, either behind the kneecap or on the inside or on the outside of the knee, or it's not the entire knee that's diseased, are candidates for a partial knee replacement. The problem with traditional partial knee replacements was the instrumentation was relatively crude, and it was difficult to get a consistent, accurate result in positioning the components. This would lead to early failure or pain after the surgery. What the Mako is a robotic arm that controls a burr to only remove the appropriate amount of bone, the minimal amount of bone, to fit the implants in the knee and to do it perfectly, accurately, so that the implants are exactly flush with the patient's native cartilage and bone tissue, and they're perfectly balancing of the ligaments. This facilitates a less painful and a faster recovery, but more importantly, it improves the durability of the partial knee replacement. So as opposed to lasting maybe only 5 years or not even that, now we're hoping that the Mako, with the newer design and the more technical accuracy that we're putting it in, it's going to last hopefully at least 15 years or more. Basically, what it involves is getting a CT scan that makes a 3D model of the knee. And then it's a virtual reality where the computer, the Mako computer, allows us to put these components on the bone in a virtual situation on the computer screen, so we get them perfectly positioned where we want them. And then when that is set, the robotic arm takes that information, we register the patient's knee with the robot, and then the burr, although we're holding it, it will not let us go out of bounds and removes only the amount of bone and cartilage necessary to insert the partial knee replacement.
Did you ever think 10 years ago when you were starting, and when you were working with your father until 2006, that any of this would come to pass? I mean, did you have any indication of any of this?
I did. I actually did have a little bit of insight in this all the way back from medical school, and it came from a welcome address, and I cannot remember the surgeon's name, but when I got accepted into Maryland, they gave us sort of a welcome to the, you know, world of medicine talk, and it was given by a physician in the military and who was working with telemedicine. Now, this is back in 1998. The military was already exploring operating robots remotely in the battlefield situation, and that's sort of where the technology got sparked from. So I had an inkling that it was coming. You know, I didn't know that it would take, you know, this many 13 years or more later. You know, here we are actually doing it, but here we are. So it's been a wonderful thing. And the technology that is involved with the robotic surgery has many more applications in orthopedic surgery, for sure. I'm sure that this robot will eventually be applied to inserting total knee replacements, not just partial knee replacement. It has wonderful applications for the shoulder replacement. It has applications for potentially for ACL reconstruction, for total ankle surgery. I mean, there's many, many applications that I think we're going to see over the next 5 to 10 years using this robotic technology.
Well, let's talk about the shoulder replacement. I've never really heard that much about shoulder replacement. What causes that, and what can you do for that?
For the most part, it's the same thing. It's arthritis, which is the wearing down of the hyaline cartilage on the end of the bone, the shoulder, that lead to shoulder arthritis, just like knee and hip arthritis. Shoulder arthritis is actually the fastest growing in terms of percentage-wise of joints to become replaced in the country right now. We're seeing more and more arthritic shoulders as the population gets older. And the demand for patients to remain functional and more active up into their elder years is higher now. So that's really pushed us to advance in terms of shoulders. The most dramatic advance that's been made in shoulders of late has been something called the reverse shoulder replacement. And the reverse shoulder replacement is a way of resurfacing that joint by placing the ball on the socket or the glenoid and placing the cup on the top of the humerus, which is the arm bone. So you can think of it similar to a hip replacement. It's a ball and socket type joint that allows for the center of rotation, the center of the joint, to be maintained on the socket in patients that do not have a functional rotator cuff. Mm-hmm. So traditional shoulder replacement looks very much like a regular shoulder, where you remove the arthritic bone, you replace it with metal and plastic parts that are basically the same shape as the patient's natural anatomy. But it required an intact rotator cuff muscle complex to center the head on the socket, to center the humeral head on the glenoid. It requires an intact rotator cuff to do that for a total shoulder replacement to be very functional. Patients who had an arthritic shoulder, had an incompetent rotator cuff, they could not pick their arm up because when they tried, the only functional muscle for them is their deltoid muscle on the outside of their shoulder. And what would happen is the arm bone would ride up and get trapped underneath the acromion bone, and the patient basically could not pick their arm up. It was very debilitating, completely dysfunctional shoulder. With the advent of the reverse shoulder replacement, the ball and socket centralizes the range of motion, the patient can then pick their arm up with their deltoid muscle almost immediately after surgery. So it was a miraculous outcome for these patients, where they go from being completely dysfunctional with their shoulder to being able to pick their arm up over their head and feed themselves and get to their hair and get to their backside. And it was just a it's just been a wonderful advance for patients suffering with something called cuff tear arthropathy, which is arthritis of the shoulder with a failed rotator cuff.
So this sounds a lot more invasive than a hip replacement. What's the time on recovery?
Actually, it's actually not.
Really?
The two are pretty synonymous. There's the typical approach to the shoulder is called the delta pectoral approach, and with that technique of getting access to the shoulder, there's only one muscle that's actually taking down. It's called the subscapularis muscle. It's the front muscle of the rotator cuff, and that is repaired back to bone typically after shoulder surgery, but it's only one muscle that's taken down, and the rest of it is done in an intramuscular plane, similar to the anterior hip. So shoulder replacements, just like hip replacements, are only in a hospital about one day, and they start range of motion pretty much right away. The only restriction is we usually restrict them on externally rotating their arm away from their side or away from about a 30-degree position to protect the muscle repair that we've done for about 4 to 6 weeks. And after that point, we allow absolutely full range of motion.
Wow.
So it's really exciting. It's the shoulders are the most exciting part of my practice at this point because of the advances that have been made in the technology and the techniques in the shoulders. The hips have been, I think, it's just awesome with the anterior approach, and I think it will continue to grow and become more popular across the country. And with the knees, I see with the advance of the robotic technology and newer techniques, we're going to see anterior cruciate ligament and ligament sparing total knee replacements in the future. And then for the shoulder, what we have now is implants that facilitate total shoulder replacement in a more balanced and accurate way that are also easily convertible to a reverse shoulder in the future. So patients that have primary shoulder replacements that end up with a rotator cuff insufficiency in the future will be easily treated by conversion of the parts without damaging any of the patient's bone or natural soft tissue so that they can get right back to an active life without too much difficulty.
So you're giving hope to extending the careers of major league pitchers?
I wouldn't go that far. It's still not recommended to be quite so active and strong on the shoulder. And that will always be the case, honestly, in terms of shoulder replacement compared to hip replacement. And that has to do with the bone stock that's available for the shoulder. The glenoid, or the socket of the shoulder, is a relatively small bone supported by the scapula, which is a very thin bone. So there's not as much technical material to work with in the shoulder like there is in the hip. The acetabulum and the pelvis provide a lot more support and bone to go ahead and go back and play tennis and golf and ski on, whereas a shoulder, you wouldn't want to necessarily go back to extreme sports or lifting activities after requiring a shoulder replacement.
But at least you got more operation with your arm.
We're not going to stop them. You know, of course, patients are going to do that anyway. And who am I to tell them? But the consequences of that failing are more significant than they are with the hip.
Right. It's used more. Plus, but at least they'll be able to have better motion with their arm, though.
Yeah, and with no pain, absolutely.
Yeah. When you started out, you said you had indication that this could come to pass. What kind of indication do you have for this 10 years down the line?
It's always hard to tell. I mean, the biggest obstacles are money and the FDA. Those are the two biggest hurdles to advancement in healthcare today. And with the Obamacare and the cut in spending and the cut in funding, there's no incentive for companies to develop any new technology because they're not getting reimbursed. And they actually, they're just getting continual cuts for the technology that they have now. And there's no, most places do not have their budget to, support new technology. So I think we're going to see this all occur first in Europe before we ever get it here, because the financial hurdles that we're experiencing now in the healthcare system. But I do see the robotic technology advancing for us. The big another big advancement will be with the biologics and stem cell research, and as that continues on, you know, the holy grail for us is being able to regrow cartilage one day. And if we can, you know, we can really figure out, we can definitely restore joints rather than replace them in the future. But they, you know, as it stands now, I have no idea. I mean, I'm, it's I'm pretty doubtful in my lifetime or in my career that I'm going to be able to see the stem cells come to fruition. But I definitely see myself doing robotic techniques for shoulder and knee replacement in the future.
So it might not be leaps and bounds, but it could be incremental through your life.
Yeah, most likely.
Is there anything else you want to add, Doctor?
No, thank you. Thank you for your time.
Okay. We've been talking to Dr. Joseph J. Ciatola, a top-rated orthopedic surgeon at Orthopedics and Joint Replacement at Mercy Medical Center. I want to thank you again, Doctor, for being on Baltimore Internet Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Dr. Joseph Ciatola is located at the Macaulay Plaza at Mercy Medical Center at 301 St. Paul Place, and his number is 410-539-2227. Thanks for listening to Baltimore Internet Radio.